Welcome to A Light on Chinese Literature from China Plus. Today we continue with the book The Spirit of the Chinese People by Malaysian Chinese scholar Gu Hongming, who lived about a century ago. Although the opinions seem dated, the book offers interesting insights into the impact of Confucianism on the Chinese people and culture. One of them being that Chinese people as a race are able to live the life of a child in their heart, and that is the secret of perpetual youth. Here is your narrator, Man Ling. Enjoy.
Now we can answer the question which we asked in the beginning. What is the real Chinaman? The real Chinaman we see now is a man who lives the life of a man of adult reason with the heart of a child. In short, the real Chinaman is a person with the head of a grown-up man and the heart of a child. The Chinese spirit, therefore, is a spirit of perpetual youth, the spirit of national immortality. Now, what is the secret of this national immortality in the Chinese people? You will remember that in the beginning of this discussion, I said, what gives to the Chinese type of humanity, to the real Chinaman? His inexpressible gentleness is the possession of what I called sympathetic or true human intelligence. This true human intelligence, I said, is the product of a combination of two things, sympathy and intelligence. It is a working together in harmony of the heart and head. In short, it is a happy union of soul with the intellect. Now, if the spirit of the Chinese people is a spirit of perpetual youth, the spirit of national immortality, the secret of this immortality is the happy union of soul with intellect. You will now ask me, where and how did the Chinese people get this secret of national immortality, this happy union of soul with intellect, which has enabled them as a race and nation to live a life of perpetual youth? The answer, of course, is that they got it from their civilization. Now, you would not expect me to give you a lecture on Chinese civilization within the time at my disposal. But I will try to tell you something of the Chinese civilization which has a beating on our present subject of discussion. Let me first of all tell you that there is, it seems to me, one great fundamental difference between the Chinese civilization and the civilization of modern Europe. Here, let me quote an admirable saying of a famous living art critic, Mr. Bernard Berenson. Comparing European with Oriental art, Mr. Berenson says, "Our European art has the fatal tendency to become science, and we hardly possess a masterpiece which does not bear the marks of having been a battlefield for divided interests." Now, what I want to say of the European civilization is that it is, as Mr. Berenson says of European art, a battlefield for divided interests, a continuous warfare for the divided interests of science and art on the one hand, and of religion and philosophy on the other. In fact, a terrible battlefield where the head and the heart, the soul and the intellect, come into constant conflict. In the Chinese civilization, at least for the last 2,400 years, there's no such conflict. That, I say, is the one great fundamental difference between the Chinese civilization and that of modern Europe. In other words, what I want to say is that in modern Europe, the people have a religion which satisfies their heart, but not their head, and a philosophy which satisfies their head, but not their heart. Now, let us look at China. Some people say that the Chinese have no religion. It is certainly true that in China, even the mass of the people do not take seriously to religion. I mean religion in the European sense of the word. The temples, rites, and ceremonies of Taoism and Buddhism in China are more objects of recreation than of edification. They touch the aesthetic sense, so to speak, of the Chinese people, rather than their moral or religious sense. In fact, they appeal more to their imagination than to their heart or soul. But instead of saying that the Chinese have no religion, it is perhaps more correct to say that the Chinese do not want, do not feel the need of religion. The truth of the matter is, the reason why the Chinese people do not feel the need of religion is because they have, in Confucianism, a system of philosophy and ethics, a synthesis of human society and civilization, which can take the place of religion. People say that Confucianism is not a religion. It is perfectly true that Confucianism is not a religion in the ordinary European sense of the word. But then I say, the greatness of Confucianism lies even in this, that it is not a religion. In fact, the greatness of Confucianism is that without being a religion, it can take the place of religion. It can make man do without religion. Now, in order to understand how Confucianism can take the place of religion, we must try and find out the reason why mankind, why men feel the need of religion. Mankind, it seems to me, feel the need of religion for the same reason that they feel the need of science, of art, and of philosophy. The reason is because man is a being who has a soul. Now, let us take science, I mean physical science. What is the reason which makes men take up the study of science? Most people now think that men do so because they want to have railways and aeroplanes. Men like the present progressive Chinamen, who take up the study of science because they want railways and aeroplanes, will never get science. The true men of science in Europe in the past, who have worked for the advancement of science and brought about the possibility of building railways and aeroplanes, did not think at all of railways and aeroplanes. What impelled those true men of science in Europe and what made them succeed in their work for the advancement of science was because they felt in their souls the need of understanding the awful mystery of the wonderful universe in which we live. Thus, mankind, I say, feel the need of religion for the same reason that they feel the need of science, art, and philosophy. And the reason is because man is a being who has a soul, and because the soul in him, which looks into the past and future as well as the present, not like animals, which live only in the present, feels the need of understanding the mystery of this universe in which they live. Until men understand something of the nature, law, purpose, and aim of the things which they see in the universe, they are like children in a dark room who feel the danger, insecurity, and uncertainty of everything. In fact, as an English poet says, the burden of the mystery of the universe weighs upon them. Therefore, mankind want science, art, and philosophy for the same reason that they want religion to lighten for them. The burden of the mystery, the heavy and the weary weight of all this unintelligible world. Art and poetry enable the artist and poet to see beauty and order in the universe, and that lightens for them the burden of this mystery. Therefore, poets like Goethe, who says, He who has art has religion. Do not feel the need of religion. Philosophy also enables the philosophers to see method and order in the universe, and that lightens for them the burden of this mystery. Therefore, philosophers like Spinoza, for whom it has been said the crown of the intellectual life is a transport, as for the saint, the crown of the religious life is a transport, do not feel the need of religion. Lastly, science also enables the scientific man to see law and order in the universe, and that lightens for them the burden of this mystery. Therefore, scientific men like Darwin and Professor Haeckel do not feel the need of religion. But for the mass of mankind who are not poets, artists, philosophers, or men of science, for the mass of mankind whose lives are full of hardships and who are exposed every moment to the shock of accident from the threatening forces of nature and the cruel, merciless passions of their fellow men, what is it that can lighten for them the burden of the mystery of all this unintelligible world? It is religion. But how does religion lighten for the mass of mankind the burden of this mystery? Religion, I say, lightens this burden by giving the mass of mankind a sense of security and a sense of permanence. In presence of the threatening forces of nature and the cruel, merciless passions of their fellow men and the mystery and terror which these inspire, religion gives to the mass of mankind a refuge in which they can find a sense of security. And that refuge is a belief in some supernatural being or beings who have absolute power and control over those forces which threaten them. Again, in presence of the constant change, vicissitude, and transition of things in their own lives, birth, childhood, youth, old age, and death, and the mystery and uncertainty which these inspire, religion gives to the mass of mankind also a refuge in which they can find a sense of permanence. And that refuge is the belief in a future life. In this way, I say, religion lightens for the mass of mankind who are not poets, artists, philosophers, or scientific men the burden of the mystery of all this unintelligible world by giving them a sense of security and a sense of permanence in their existence. Christ said, "Peace I give unto you, peace which the world cannot give, and which the world cannot take away from you." This is what I mean when I say that religion gives to the mass of mankind a sense of security and a sense of permanence. Therefore, unless you can find something which can give to the mass of mankind the same peace, the same sense of security and of permanence which religion affords them, the mass of mankind will always feel the need of religion. But I said, Confucianism, without being a religion, can take the place of religion. Therefore, there must be something in Confucianism which can give to the mass of mankind the same sense of security and permanence which religion affords them.
From China Plus, China Plus, you're listening to A Light on Chinese Literature.
Let us now find out what this something is in Confucianism, which can give the same sense of security and sense of permanence that religion gives. I have often been asked to say what Confucius has done for the Chinese nation. Now, I can tell you of many things which I think Confucius has accomplished for the Chinese people. But as today I have not the time, I will only here try to tell you of one principle and most important thing which Confucius has done for the Chinese nation, the one thing he did in his life by which Confucius himself said men in after ages would know him, would know what he had done for them. When I have explained to you this one principal thing, you will then understand what that something is in Confucianism, which can give to the mass of mankind the same sense of security and sense of permanence which religion affords them. In order to explain this, I must ask you to allow me to go a little more into detail about Confucius and what he did. Confucius, as some of you may know, lived in what is called a period of expansion in the history of China, a period in which the feudal age had come to an end, in which the feudal, the semi-patriarchal social order and form of government, had to be expanded and reconstructed. This great change necessarily brought with it not only confusion in the affairs of the world, but also confusion in men's minds. I have said that in the Chinese civilization of the last 2,500 years, there is no conflict between the heart and the head. But I must now tell you that in the period of expansion in which Confucius lived, there was also in China, as now in Europe, a fearful conflict between the heart and the head. The Chinese people in Confucius' time found themselves with an immense system of institutions, established facts, accredited dogmas, customs, laws, in fact, an immense system of society and civilization which had come down to them from their venerated ancestors. In this system, their life had to be carried forward, yet they began to feel, they had a sense, that this system was not of their creation, that it by no means corresponded with the wants of their actual life, that for them it was customary, not rational. Now, the awakening of this sense in the Chinese people 2,500 years ago was the awakening of what in Europe today is called the modern spirit, the spirit of liberalism, the spirit of inquiry, to find out the why and the wherefore of things. This modern spirit in China then, seeing the want of correspondence of the old order of society and civilization with the wants of their actual life, set itself not only to reconstruct a new order of society and civilization, but also to find a basis for this new order of society and civilization. But all the attempts to find a new basis for society and civilization in China then failed. Some, while they satisfied the head, the intellect of the Chinese people, did not satisfy their heart. Others, while they satisfied their heart, did not satisfy their head. Hence arose, as I said, this conflict between the heart and the head in China 2,500 years ago, as we see it now in Europe. This conflict of the heart and head in the new order of society and civilization, which men tried to reconstruct, made the Chinese people feel dissatisfied with all civilization. And in the agony and despair which this dissatisfaction produced, the Chinese people wanted to pull down and destroy all civilization. Men like Lao Tzu, then in China, as men like Tolstoy in Europe today, seeing the misery and suffering resulting from the conflict between the heart and the head, thought they saw something radically wrong in the very nature and constitution of society and civilization. Lao Tzu and Chuang Tzu, the most brilliant of Lao Tzu's disciples, told the Chinese people to throw away all civilization. Lao Tzu said to the people of China, "Leave all that you have and follow me. Follow me to the mountains, to the hermit's cell in the mountains, there to live a true life, a life of the heart, a life of immortality." But Confucius who also saw the suffering and misery of the then state of society and civilization, thought he recognized that the evil was not in the nature and constitution of society and civilization, but in the wrong track which society and civilization had taken, in the wrong basis which men had taken for the foundation of society and civilization. Confucius told the Chinese people not to throw away their civilization. Confucius told them that in a true society and true civilization, in a society and civilization with a true basis, men also could live a true life, a life of the heart. In fact, Confucius tried hard all his life to put society and civilization on the right track, to give it a true basis, and thus prevent the destruction of civilization. But in the last days of his life, when Confucius saw that he could not prevent the destruction of the Chinese civilization, what did he do? Well, as an architect who sees his house on fire, burning and falling over his head, and is convinced that he cannot possibly save the building, knows that the only thing for him to do is to save the drawings and plans of the building so that it may afterwards be built again. So Confucius, seeing the inevitable destruction of the building of the Chinese civilization, which he could not prevent, thought he would save the drawings and plans, and he accordingly saved the drawings and plans of the Chinese civilization, which are now preserved in the Old Testament of the Chinese Bible, the five canonical books known as the Wu Qing, the five canons. That, I say, was a great service which Confucius has done for the Chinese nation. He saved the drawings and plans of their civilization for them. Confucius, I say, when he saved the drawings and plans of the Chinese civilization, did a great service for the Chinese nation. But that is not the principle, the greatest service which Confucius has done for the Chinese nation. The greatest service he did was that in saving the drawings and plans of their civilization, he made a new synthesis, a new interpretation of the plans of that civilization. And in that new synthesis, he gave the Chinese people the true idea of a state, a true, rational, permanent, absolute basis of a state.
This has been a China Plus production. Thanks for listening. If you like the show, be sure to subscribe to the podcast for free. If you have any comments about the episodes, just send us an email, podcast@cri.com.cn. We are also on Facebook and Twitter @China Plus News.